I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. In 2011, Egyptians took to the streets to protest the policies of their government, and Tahrir Square in Cairo became a focal point of the revolution. Our guest, Bassem Youssef, a cardiac surgeon, went to the square to provide medical treatment and was radicalized himself. He began posting satirical commentary on YouTube that quickly became a sensation and a popular TV show called Al Bernameg, watched by some 30 million people who loved his use of comedy to confront corruption, stupidity, and hypocrisy. He also faced death threats, was arrested, and in 2014 fled to Dubai, eventually ending up in Los Angeles, where he lives now. Bassem Youssef has been busy since coming to America with a show on Fusion called Democracy Handbook, a book titled Revolution for Dummies, a documentary about him, Tickling Giants, and a new podcast, Remade in America. He's in Philadelphia to perform his stand-up show, The Joke is Mightier Than the Sword. It's tonight at 7:30 at the Kimmel Center, part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. Bassem Youssef joins us on Radio Times to talk about satire, the Middle East, the United States, politics, his life, and whatever else we can fit into the hour. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I was a little bit scared when you said he became radicalized, and I kept looking at the door. like, are we going to be stormed by the FBI?
You're safe, I think.
There's not this kind of radicalization, guys. Not this kind.
The good kind, right?
The good kind, yes.
So why is satire so threatening to dictators, authoritarian governments, to bossy bosses?
Because people like these, they only have one thing to show up for, which is fake respect.
Fake respect.
And fear. So they have to make you in this position, respecting them and fearing them the whole time, because they don't have any other thing to show up for. They don't have any kind of achievements. They don't have any kind of sound ideology. Just this. And when you make fun of them, you take this away from them, and they have nothing else to show up for. So it's kind of like it's fear and fake respect is very fragile and could be pretty much swept away with satire and humor.
But I think of satire as coming from several different places. One, of course, is anger, suffering, I would think, to some degree. I mean, in order to ridicule something, something bad has to have happened. Where does that come from?
Well, it depends, really, because maybe in a stable democracy like the United States, it kind of like comes from like, hey, let's make fun of the government. But in a place that was precarious, like in Egypt, where we have to go through, it can actually come from fear and suffering big time. And maybe this will be the only way to make fun of the government, because we don't have the luxury of changing things every couple of years or midterms or elections. And sometimes when you see the whole society being either radicalized religiously or radicalized military, mm-hmm. it becomes your last line of defense, and sometimes you lose. It's not always a happy ending. I had to leave, and this is where you realize that satire and humor have a limit.
Yes, well, it's interesting because your show, how satire is mightier than, or no, how jokes,
the joke is mightier than
the sword. But is that true? I mean, you're the person who had to, in a sense, run for your life.
I think, here's the thing. In a battle, the sword will always win. I mean, let's be realistic.
Right, exactly.
But I think the way that I chose the joke is mightier than the sword is like the joke being not having any kind of might or strength other than having a joke. It just shows how weak the sword is. And sometimes you striking someone down is a sign of weakness, not a sign of strength. And how can you be so pushed to perform kind of unnecessary violence or oppression because you can't handle a joke.
Right.
And this is why the joke is mightier, because it shows your weakness.
Well, it's interesting. There was a piece today, actually it was in the Washington Post by someone you know.
Aya Hejazi,
talking about Egypt and also talking about President Sisi's crackdown and brutality. And among the people who have been arrested in the last couple of months is a guy named Shadi Abu Zayed.
Abu Zayed, yes. So the thing is, Shadi
is he's a satirical blogger, as I understand.
He's a satirical blogger, and he's a friend of mine, and he's actually one of five or six people that I know of personally that were taken off from their houses only in the last month. And I'm saying 5 or 6, but there are like hundreds and thousands of people in jail. But this is just in the last 4 months. There is Shadi, there is Wael Abbas, there is another guy called Shadi Ghazali, and there is Haytham Hamadin, and there is Ahmed Al-Garhi, who actually used to work on my show.
Wow.
And these people are taken for the most trivial thing because they either said, like, wrote a Facebook post, or even Shadi Bouzid didn't actually write anything for the last 2 years. And they're just like taking people away, which is very sad.
If you had not fled,
I would be in their position 100%. No popularity, no viewership would have protected me.
Let's talk a bit about your show, which, as I understand it, in its heyday, something like 40% of Egypt's population would tune in to watch it. I mean, these are, I think, Super Bowl numbers or even beyond that. Why do you think it had such a huge following?
Because for years we do have a very old tradition of comedy and satire, but political satire was never that direct.
Right.
I think it was a break for people to see that, like, you can actually hold someone accountable and make fun of the biggest head in the country. And we did that with the military council, we did that with the Islamists, we did that with Sisi. And even a lot of people didn't like that because they're not used to that, but they continued to hate watch.
Oh, hate watch. Well, we know all about hate watching.
So I think a big part of these numbers are hate watching.
Right. Or just to be angry at you,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. So they can talk to me and then analyze it on their blogs and curse me.
Well, I would assume if you're making fun of Morsi, then you've got supporters and critics. And then if you switch and you're making fun of al-Sisi, you've got supporters and critics, but they probably are completely different.
Absolutely, yeah. It's funny how I was like the number one hero, a national hero for people when the Islamists were deposed. And then overnight I became the number one enemy because the supporters of the military didn't like what I had to do. Even people from my own family.
Even your own family?
Oh, yeah. I'm disowned by many people of my family.
Truly disowned?
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to have anything to do with you?
Yeah.
Huh? Wow. How about your parents?
Well, my parents both, like, my father was always supportive. He was reserved because he's like a traditional man. He doesn't want any trouble. My mom sadly died before I did the switch, but like she saw that I was already writing against the military when the coup happened, and she was not happy.
Because her son was a surgeon. And
No, she supported my career, but the thing is, you have to understand for a certain generation, the military is even more sacred than religion. So they consider any criticism of the military threatens the country. The whole thing about if you don't stand to the flag, you're not patriot.
Has a kind of familiar ring to it, doesn't it?
Oh, it's just this is political, emotional blackmail. Patriotic, nationalistic, sometimes religious blackmail. So they're always going to have a way to blackmail you. If you're making fun of the Islamists, so you're making fun of God, making fun of the religion. If you're making fun of someone, of a strong man, you're making fun of the country. I mean, remember, like, the last State of the Union speech when Trump said, I think those people who didn't stand up and clap, maybe they should be tried for treason. The whole thing is like, me equal the country, equal the nation, equal patriotism, equal nationalism, equal religion. It's the same equation everywhere.
You made fun of Morsi's hat. As I understand it, that was the thing that really got you in trouble, or maybe it was a cumulative effect.
Yeah, yeah. It just like, you know, this is one thing. It's like, you insulted our president by wearing a hat?
And it was a 3-foot-tall hat,
yeah,
right?
I just took a hat that he was wearing and just like multiplied it by 50. and that was enough to make people, you know, just riled up. And of course, the people who were against the Muslim Brotherhood celebrated that. And I remember I went to the general prosecutor because I was, you know, I was went there for questioning.
Yes.
And I wore the hat.
And you did wear the hat. And how did that go?
Well, it couldn't fit into the room, so I had to leave it outside the building.
But point made, right? Point made.
Yeah.
It's about ridicule.
You
right?
can't just like go behind, like after a joker because you're going to make yourself look stupid.
It's funny because Stephen Colbert does a thing with a hat as well. But I watched some of your show, and you were very physical. I mean, there were a lot of gestures and facial expressions. And oftentimes with Stephen Colbert, he'll just sort of arch an eyebrow.
Yes.
Is that a cultural difference, or is it just stylistic difference?
No, I think it's like what the joke will – sometimes I'll do the joke more straight, and sometimes I'll be more animated. And it really depends on how it is. Right. You know, I think it depends on the situation.
You worked as a cardiac surgeon.
Yes.
We often talk about the gallows humor in an operating room.
Mm-hmm.
Were you that kind of a surgeon?
Absolutely. But, like, not just me. Every surgeon is like that.
When we're all
How can you survive, like, an eight-hour surgery?
Right.
When
you're looking inside someone's chest.
Yes.
I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they say that the best jokes are actually made inside the surgical theater, not the other theater.
With what, silent guffaws as the joke goes around? You don't laugh too hard, I guess.
Well, I think the rule is, if you are the surgeon, the main surgeon, anything that you say is funny.
Oh.
You cannot not laugh at the main surgeon.
It didn't work out for your TV show, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
As you're writing your book, it didn't seem like you exactly wanted to be a surgeon. Should I read that right?
Yeah, well, you know, there when you are, you have limited choices when you are in the Middle East. You either become a doctor, an engineer, or a disappointment.
Ah.
And so I had to follow suit and kind of like please my parents.
In fact, you write about your mother. I think many mothers are secretly mob bosses. I gave him an offer he couldn't refuse.
Yes, exactly.
That was your mom?
Exactly. That's my mom. And she was a very strong woman. And she was the one who was like controlling the house. My dad was just like very chill. Like, you know, it's kind of like a very classical scene from Married with Kids.
Yeah.
We're just like sitting on the couch, just like giving money. He's like, I don't want to be bothered. That's why he was so cool.
We're almost up in a break here. Do you miss doing surgery?
No.
No. Why?
It's too taxing. And I think it's a thankless job. And I really appreciate everybody who stuck to this job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't regret it. I spent 19 years between a student and a practicing doctor. I think it built character. Mm-hmm. But thank you so much for building the character. I got all the character I need.
I read somewhere that you took a medical exam for the states here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, the clinical exam, the clinical part of the CSA, the clinical part of the USMLE. I took it here in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Bassem Youssef joining us on Radio Times today. He's in Philadelphia for his stand-up show. It's called The Joke is Mightier Than the Sword. It's tonight at 7:30 at the Kimmel Center, and again, part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. We've been talking about satire and comedy and politics and Egypt and the United States. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Bassem Youssef about his life in Egypt. And for a time, he had one of the most popular shows in the Arab world. And one of his guests was a fellow named John Stewart. And here's a clip from Stewart's appearance on Youssef's show called The Show. And this is June 21st, 2013.
So you are, of course, one of the most, I mean, I've just known you, and I've read that you're some sort of a satirist. In
yes,
the United States.
I am the comedian
yes.
of sorts.
And the thing is, does satire put you, like, gets you into trouble? I mean, what about the love you get from the people?
I'll tell you this, it doesn't get me into the kind of trouble it gets you into. I get in trouble, but nowhere near what happens to you.
You are in the Middle East, it's close, you're getting
yes.
close, yes.
It is. I do Bassem's job in a country that has carved out already. It is settled law. Satire is settled law. Governments have realized that jokes, if your regime is not strong enough to handle a joke, then you don't have a regime. Because...
Do you think satire is settled law in the United States of America?
I think I do. Because, like... You can get the president all angry or whatever, but he cannot really shut down a show. He can tweet about it. He can lash about it. He can curse it, but he cannot shut it down. It is there to stay, and this is the difference. The people in my part of the world don't even have to tweet or lash at anything. They just one phone call, and it's done.
You went to Tahrir Square and saw something different from what was getting reported by the, I guess, the government-controlled media.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, the definition of fake news. What was the media saying, and what did you see?
I think we coined the term fake news before it was fake news. The idea of, like, calling everybody traitors and operatives and wanting to destroy the country. This is the whole thing. Anything that will threaten the position of an authoritarian government must be a conspiracy from abroad. And what is funny is that the abroad, which is Israel, America, all of these players, Europe, the regime is in bed with all of these people. I mean, they get their military aid from America, and yet they call it the biggest conspiracy against them. Why don't you just sever the ties? But they can't. So it has always been the Egyptian-Israeli relationship has never been better, and yet they call everybody who is like protesting against Sisi an Israeli spy, which is it's just like it's fine if you want to have a relationship with whoever, but this whole thing of like the double think, the George Orwell double think mentality, it's just crazy.
Where what's essentially what is up is down.
Yeah.
What's in is out.
Yes.
You write in this book, and this you say, this despised America is a dream destination for many of Egypt's hypocrites. Some of the most outspoken opponents of America send their kids to American schools and universities. When these people get sick, they travel to get treated in America, and you go on from there.
Not just that. There are people who actually live in the United States, who've been living in the United States. Egyptians have been living here for like 30, 40 years. They have the American nationality, and they are convinced that America is conspiring in Egypt. They go and they are paying taxes every year for the same federal government that is conspiring against your country, which is crazy.
You want to name names so we know who these people are?
No, they're everywhere. I mean, yeah. There's a certain generation. But don't you see that? It's just like it's the same kind of supporters who say like, America, nationalism, but they don't have any problem with kind of calling Putin a great president. Or not being bothered at all by the Russian ties of Trump. It's the doublethink. Doublethink is everywhere. It's like the evangelists who hate the Jews, but they love Israel.
Which was on display with the moving of the embassy.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like it's the whole thing. It's just like the hypocrisy and the twisting the facts. It's just like facts are relative now. It's just like facts don't matter, and I've seen that in Egypt. I'm seeing it here, and it just sort of drives me crazy.
Which drives you crazier than hypocrisy, stupidity, corruption? All three.
But they all come together.
They do all come together.
You can't really separate them because one leads to the other. One empowers the other. One enables the other.
Do you see then parallels between the Egypt that you left and the America that you live in?
No, I see parallels in mentality. But not in the system, because so far we can joke all we can about like how this is pretty much like the Middle East. But to be fair, there is still a lot of tools that you can resist and use that, because we don't have federal judges that can stand against the president and stop him. We don't have people who can change an election every a couple of years and change the constitution or the composition of the House and the Senate that can actually stand against the president. It's just like what happened a couple of years ago, that it was like a huge sweep, presidency, Senate, and House that like went to one party, right. That like a crazy party.
For a short period of time.
For a short period. But like there's always been a resistance, and now you've seen seats being flipped everywhere. In the most unlikely places like Alabama. So at least you can make this change. And not all of the damages are irreversible.
Do you feel like you're in exile
No.
No.
I mean,
is this your country?
I'm liking it here. Uh-huh. And even my material and my jokes are more about someone who lives in America, not someone who still just living in that place. And that's actually part of the it's making a lot of people disappointed at me.
Oh. They wanted me
to be the same thing. It's just like Albert Namig had its legacy, but it had its time and it had its circumstances.
That was your show, yeah.
Right now, I'm someone who lives in America, and I cannot just talk about the day-to-day life, what's happening in Egypt, because if my audience now is in the United States, I have to adapt to what my life is here. Hopefully my future and my future of my kids are here, and I have to make sure that they grow up in a country where they're not being discriminated against because of the color of their skin, because of where they come from, because of their background. And this is another fight. It's an important fight because, again, it's a double thing. Although the same people who are saying, you have to talk about what's here, but like they also complain about like not having a voice in the media.
Yeah.
So maybe I want to be one of those voices.
Well, I was watching some of your Democracy Handbook, and it is an outsider coming to America and learning about gerrymandering and the Second Amendment and kind of with this sense of just what the heck is going on here?
Yes.
Do you still have that feel now that you know this country a little bit better?
No, of course. It's just like it is very interesting to know about America, but like the one thing that really boggles me politically is how all of these candidates running for the Senate, running for the Congress, running for presidency, running for even local elections, how these people just like go and they are courting the voters to get their voices. And once they are in their position, all their positions are driven by the donations from the lobbyists and the big industries, which are totally against the best interests of the voters.
Mm.
This is like a huge split. How are you voting for stuff that actually hurt your voters and you still keep your seat?
Yeah.
How are you, it's kind of like there's this very trivial story about, you know, the penny.
The little brown penny.
It costs 1.7 cents. to produce 1 cent. And it's costing the American government about $50 million a year.
To make pennies
more than it should be. And the only reason they are in circulation is that there's a lobbyist for, I think, the nickels or the coppers or whatever who are doing that penny, who pay $5 million in lobbying every year for people in the House and the Congress to continue making the penny. So you are paying $5 million, you're getting $50 million back. This is bribery. If this is not bribery, the NRA is a perfect example. Everybody knows that these guns are killing people, but they don't have some spineless people in the Congress and in the House, and they are voting for killing other Americans because they are taking money from the NRA. This is bribery. Mm. If this is not, I can't find any other name. This is a bribe. These are people are being bribed in order to hurt the best interest of their voters, and they don't care about anything other than being reelected. And I don't know how can you break the cycle, because it's becoming crazy. The whole thing about the big cheese industries, the big dairy industry, and how they're putting more cheese in the lunch of children, which it's not healthy, guys. And yet it's because they are paying them money. I don't understand. This is like a turning into more of an oligarchy mode than a democracy.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, in certain ways, there's some fodder for your acts or your whatever you're doing here in America. But I'm also thinking we have an education secretary who heads up a committee to look at violence in schools and said yesterday that they're not going to look at guns.
Yeah, because like guns, I mean, what does guns have to do anything with school? This is like a perfect example. She is bribed by the NRA. And I'm using this word on purpose, because this is bribery. If you don't look at school shooting and you look at video games, you're either ignorant or stupid, and I don't think she's any either, or you're just being you're a sellout. You're being bought.
That is our guest, Bassem Youssef, joining us today on Radio Times for a whole host of reasons. The main one is he's got a show tonight at the Kimball Center at 7:30, part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. It's called The Joke is Mightier Than the Sword. He was known for a time as the Jon Stewart of the Middle East. I don't know if Bassem Youssef still likes that or not.
Anything that puts me in with Jon Stewart in the same sentence, good. I hope he doesn't get bored or like get fed up of that.
Although you had a much bigger audience than he did, I have to say.
Yeah, because just like here, you have more competition, and in Egypt, they were basically the only ones. So.
And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do you feel like you're part of, there are a group of political satirists in this country, Jon Stewart being one, Stephen Colbert, Seth Meyers, Samantha Bee, I mean, there's a long list of people. Do you feel like you're part of that? Are you?
I'm still trying to get into the club.
I was big
in my country. I'm still trying to make it here in this country.
A special handshake or something to get in?
I don't know. Maybe I had to join the Freemasons or something.
Have you ever said something for which you felt you had to apologize for?
No, I don't think I did. I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm sure I did stuff that was not right at the moment. But like hindsight is 20/20, mm-hmm. and you do stuff judging the position and the circumstances at the time.
Yeah. When you think of satire, I don't know how many rules there are, but is it? Should it be pointed at those people who are in power, the elite, the powerful, the political?
Yes, I believe so. I believe so because there is no glory of making fun of the weak person. And this is what people, the supporters of the military, didn't understand when I had my show in the last season. They say, like, you should get away. It's like, no, I that's my job. It's the media and authority. Mm-hmm. That's what you should focus on.
Did you feel like you were being courageous with your show?
No, I didn't feel I was being courageous. I was feeling that I was doing my job. That's mm-hmm. the job. If that's a job description. If you don't do it, that's it. Yeah. I mean, that's not, you're not a satirist anymore. You're not into political satire anymore. You can call this any other kind of show.
Were you surprised that it just was so popular?
I was surprised it was so popular, and how fast it became popular. And it comes with a price because when you are watched by everybody, everybody expects you to do everything that they want exactly. Right. And I had to come up like multiple times to say, I'm not a political activist, I'm not a freedom fighter, I'm a satirist, I'm a comedian, and that is the limits of the show. You cannot just, because you're disappointed because of the performance of other politicians and other media outlets that you think that I'm going to solve the problems, I'm not.
Do you find that there's a version of that? I mean, we are a very segregated, segmented, divided country in this country.
I know, but that's not the position of the satirist or the comedian to fix that.
Right.
We just hold the mirror to this society and tell the and use humor to kind of water down to make people think about it, but it's not people are the ones who's going to make the change, not us.
You were on actually Samantha Bee's show, I think a little more than a year ago, and you said if Trump was running for president in the Middle East, he'd be classified as a tree hugging liberal.
Yes, a classic line. Yeah, it's kind of compared to the kind of like the unchecked authoritarian dictatorship that we have. Yeah, Trump. Mm-hmm. Trump is very small league.
Small league compared to
small league or little league? How do you call it? Well, he's small and little in so many aspects.
But do you see parallels, though?
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, I think if Trump didn't have all of these checks and balances, he would definitely abuse his power. Definitely, he's not being a dictator because of the goodness of his heart. It's just because the system doesn't allow him.
Do you find yourself sort of being a go-between between the United States and the Middle East, broadly speaking, or even Egypt? That here's someone who has lived in both worlds, in a sense, and perhaps even through satire understands things that other people don't.
No, I don't think I understand other people, but I've just like seen extent of authoritarian of what a Donald Trump would be if he goes unchecked. And not just that, like the mentality of the people who support him no matter what he does. If we didn't have the checks and balances, those supporters mm-hmm. would be very happy if he shut down CNN and he shut down MSNBC or he shut down the New York Times. And it doesn't matter. Now, if freedom of speech doesn't matter because of the security of the country comes first.
Hmm.
It's the same thing. And I'm not saying all his supporters. I'm saying like a good chunk of his supporters, the same people who goes out in marches and shout against the Muslims and the Jews.
You've interviewed some of those folks, haven't you?
What? Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. One of them was an owner of a gun store in Florida, who had a Muslim free gun store. Yeah, he didn't.
No Muslims allowed.
No Muslims allowed. No Muslims and dogs allowed. and I interviewed him. I didn't know I was a Muslim, and I pretended to be half Italian.
Half Italian. What was the other half?
I never told him. It was just like the fact that I was sitting there, like standing there listening to the most vile racist mm-hmm. thing that he was saying about like people like me. And I didn't even try to stop him. I just let him go.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Bassem Youssef is our guest. We're talking about his life, his career in Egypt, also talking about what he has found now living in the United States, and the fact that he's got a show here in Philadelphia performing tonight at 7:30 at the Kimmel Center. The Joke is Mightier Than the Sword, again, part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. We have touched on a lot of topics. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Bassem Youssef is our guest, and he's got a book called Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring, and again, he's got a show here in Philadelphia, The Joke is Mightier Than the Sword. Let me play another clip, and this takes us to 2015, Bassem Youssef appearing on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Let's give it a listen.
Obviously, right now, the Middle East spiraling out of control. So tell me, what should America do about this?
Well, how about nothing? Oh, thank you. Oh. Yes. I feel the love, yes.
Yeah. Okay, we haven't tried that one yet.
Yeah, we noticed. How do you think our region got this way in the first place? For decades, America propped up a who's who of military and theocratic dictators. They gave you what you wanted. Oil. Airfields. Oil. Security arrangements. Oil. And let's not forget a few torture black sites.
Hey, hey. Mrs. Robinson, are you trying to seduce me?
We know what you're into. Mr. Gray will see you now. And in return, the dictators got someone their people could hate instead of them. When the garbage back home doesn't get picked up for a week, who do you think people blame?
I'm going to go with the... That's an easy one. I'm going to go with the sanitation department.
Exactly. We blame America.
3 years old, but that holds up.
Yep. It's been the American policy in the Middle East forever.
And I like the idea of just do nothing, right?
Yeah.
Leave us alone.
Yeah, but I think I don't know, if you're the greatest power, like the biggest power in the world, you have to do something with the power, or else we're going to use all of these military expenditure.
is something like that, was that scripted, or how much of that was improv?
It's kind of like 50-50.
50-50, yeah. I mean, you and John, you have great chemistry.
He's a lovely person.
Yeah.
I miss him.
And did you love him before you met him?
Oh, yeah. I've been watching him forever. Like 2002, 2003, you've been watching him regularly.
Tell us about the thinking that's going into this show you're going to do tonight.
So it basically tracks my journey from the Middle East during the Arab Spring all the way here as an immigrant in Trump's America. And it's kind of more of an observational reflection comedy about what is it to be an Arab, a Muslim, in the Middle East or in here? And how do I see all the crazy things played out? And it's not like just like me just making fun of America, but also I make fun of ourselves too, as people in the Middle East. We do have a lot of stuff to be made fun of. So it's kind of like it's a mixture of a stand-up, a storytelling, a history lesson, and a reflection of everything happening in the world.
You have to, I just wonder how different.
And I'm going to do a little bit of burlesque too.
A little bit of burlesque. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But how much do you have to, I guess, fine-tune things depending on where you're performing? I mean, Egypt versus the United States.
Yeah, of course. No, in America, it's a totally different mode. Because it's a different language, different delivery, different everything. I'm still learning that.
Right.
I'm still rewiring my brain to deliver different.
Different and, pacing?
Everything. It's just like the whole thing is different. I think it's much quicker in Arabic. And sometimes that doesn't work in my behalf. You think it's easier, it's going to be slower because my Arabic brain is still there, so I go quicker where I should go slower. And sometimes it's just it's a different mode altogether. I just have to switch everything off and kind of relearn and teach myself differently.
Can you tell that on stage? I mean, I can't imagine anything scarier than, frankly, being on a stage by oneself. Well, I mean, I guess that seems kind of scary to me.
In a good night, you can tell. In a bad night, you can't.
Yeah. And then what, you get self-conscious, I guess?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes. Yeah. It's just like, and also there's a challenge of like the room, because what kind of audience, especially if, are these like Arabic audience that are only expecting one thing? Because I had people having like a problem, like even Arabs here, but like I was talking about American politics right. And it doesn't fly.
Right.
So I say a certain joke that like the white people will just like, be on the floor, and the Arabs, I didn't get that, but it because it's pretty much American, and so kind of like you're writing for American audience, including Arabs living in America who should know more about America.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
can you read an audience? Sort of as you're standing there?
Sometimes I do, but like if you already have prepared your material, it's going to be difficult.
Do you get nervous before
performing? I always get nervous, yeah. So, guys, if you want to come and see somebody's doing great or doing terribly, it's going to be fun either ways. Come tonight.
You had a character on your show, Antifajita?
Antifajita, yes.
Yes.
She's a puppet, and now she took my place and took my theater, and now she has her own show.
Yeah. Though she get in trouble?
Yeah, well, she made fun of some of the conspiracy theories, and that led her in trouble because how dare you make fun of conspiracy theories? It's the conspiracy theories that keeps us alive. Yes.
And what, I mean, how does a government deal with an actual puppet?
The government doesn't deal with an actual puppet. The government pushes its surrogates, its proxies to actually take her to court.
Oh, wow. Well. So she went to court.
Yeah, and that it's kind of like there was also another like legal complaint, and sponsors had to pull out an ad that was featuring the puppet. It is sad.
Interviewed a Turkish novelist not so long ago who was put on trial because one of the characters in her novel did something that offended the government. I mean, and her name, of course, just flew out of my head.
Oh my God! I know. She's a friend of mine, and I interviewed her about this exact thing.
Yeah.
Oh my God! She's gonna hate me.
Well, we'll see if our producer can Google. We'll fix this. Yes, he's on it. I saw a thumb up in the air.
Yeah.
But that's just the sort of absurdity of that is just mind blowing.
Well, here's the and just like what you just said, it's a proof that it's not just satire and humor. Any kind of imagination. Of creativity is a threat for an authoritarian mind because imagination and creativity liberates the mind, and that's the last thing a dictator wants, a liberated mind. And this is why for the classics like 1984, you will find that any kind of creativity is not allowed. Even creativity in love, you only marry for procreation, not love. If the party knows that you're in love, they're going to annul the marriage. So any kind of emotions, any kind of free will, any kind of free thinking is not welcomed.
Elif Shafak.
Elif.
Elif. Thank you, John Ahrens. Thank goodness for the internet to be able to deal with stuff like that. Comment from Gary: Bassam may have his roots in Egypt, but I see him as a true American in spirit. Do you feel like an American in spirit?
If that's good enough. I think we're all human in spirit. Right. I think what he meant is like being human. And because I think a good American and a good Egyptian and a good European have more in common than a bad American, a bad Egyptian, a bad Arab. It's just like I think we're all, this is what we try to do, is like to be more humane and be more accepting to other people. And this is why I'll find to be connecting with people from other culture more than I will connect people who don't share these kind of values in my own culture.
Was it an adjustment, though, for you? And you know, I mean, in certain ways, you had to flee your country. To leave, I'm assuming you still have family there, probably have friends who are there.
Yeah.
You mentioned some of them earlier. To leave all that behind and come to this new, strange, big country.
Yeah. Of course, like the transition was not very smooth.
Right.
But it's not like I've been here before.
You're doing okay.
It just like it's difficult when you do it in an older age, when you have a whole family with you, a wife and a kid, and now we have two. But at that time, it's just like it's not just you. If it was me, I can just like jump on a plane and come. But you have to kind of uproot a whole family and start all over again.
Yeah.
And I'm not 22 years old waiting table in Hollywood waiting for them to call. I have to reinvent my career at the age of 44, which is not very easy.
But you've done pretty well.
We'll see.
Democracy Handbook, a book, a documentary about you, Tickling Giants. You got a new podcast.
It doesn't matter until you are on the network.
Oh, that's your...
Until you have a sitcom...
Is that your goal? Is that
No, not necessarily, but like an Oscar would be nice.
Thinking big, right?
Yeah, an Oscar, an Emmy, Tony,
yeah,
the Grammy.
I forget what that word is when you get all of them. But
yeah, although I can't sing, but like, yeah, any of them
Why
would
not?
Be nice. Yeah.
Can you go back to Egypt?
I can go back, but I don't know if I can leave.
Oh.
You never know, because there's no rules anymore. And I don't know what are the rules. And it's just like I don't want to take the chance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you been in – does the government talk about you or say things about you?
Well, I think they – like I stopped – I think they stopped talking about me a year ago.
Oh.
Because I stopped talking about them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's called EGOT. Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony. EGOT.
Oh, it's an EGOT?
And that's – yeah.
That sounds like a very – foreign name.
A comment from Clark says, Bassam advocated for non-intervention in the Middle East in the clip that you played. I'm curious about his position on U.S. involvement in Syria, if he has one. Do you have one?
Well, the thing is, I think all countries will be, countries get involved with each other. The idea is, how are you going to get involved? The problem with the American involvement in the Middle East, they're always in power dictators. And then when things goes too bad, they go and invade the countries with the dictators. Then they prop up a different government. They give us weapons. And then they go in and intervene again. It just, the problem is there always been a duality between either religion or military. In the Middle East. And being a military doesn't mean that you're secular, by the way. And you cannot just support a dictatorship and expect good results. So the fact is, if you want to interfere, fine, but interfere for the sake of true democracy and true freedom, but not for the sake of empowering dictators. It's a big difference.
You lived under the Muslim Brotherhood for a bit, and then, of course, under the military. Was that vastly different experience? I know you got arrested under one but had to flee under the other.
Well, the thing is, the military have 6 years under the belt of experience of how to be dictators.
Oh. They're better at it?
They're better at it. I think the Muslim Brotherhood didn't have a chance to become one, but I think they're on their way. Because the ideology is one. The ideology is one. The Muslim Brotherhood were pro-military until the military just turned them around. I mean, they were kissing their butts the whole time. And they would be very happy if the reverse had happened and the military has actually ousted us. Now they are of course victimizing themselves because they lost. But they were in power and position, and we saw that what kind of ideology of eliminating the others was. I think there are two sides of the same coin, and I think just one of them want to use the gun to get to power, protected with the Quran. The one wants the Quran to get to the power and protected with the gun.
Wow. That's pretty succinct. You write that before, I guess, the Arab Spring, you were pretty apolitical. And I wonder, does that happen in a sense, in a dictatorship?
Not apolitical as much as apathetic.
Oh, apathetic.
When you're living 30 years under the same ruler, it kind of you lose hope of change, nothing going to happen.
Yeah.
But not just me, everybody else. I mean, when the revolution came, a lot of people who were never involved in politics became involved. They thought, now we can make a change. This is what you feel here. When you see that there is a chance of change, that's why you see people going to the poll and people being active. It is in the best interest in any dictatorship is to make people inactive, politically inactive as possible. They don't want to deal with the masses. They just want a kind of a sample of people who go there and show that we have some sort of a democratic process.
What happened to the Arab Spring? Did it go underground? Was it just crushed by the government, the military?
I think of course it was crushed, but I think this is a prequel of something else. I think it does look bad right now. But now you have a whole generations of younger people who now don't have the same sacred taboos that they cannot talk about anymore. They can question it. They're questioning everything now, whether in religion, military, nationalism, everything. So it kind of opened the doors. The fact that they are not very active in the streets or anything, maybe because out of safety. But I think it makes it very difficult to control them the same way their parents were controlled through empty propaganda from the 60s.
Oh, because of Twitter, for instance. I mean, just
because of the whole thing, because the whole process of things, because of the whole events. And I always say revolution is not an event, it's a process. And it takes years.
Well, it's been such a pleasure, Bassem.
Thank you so much.
Youssef, for joining us. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. We have been talking about his life in Egypt, what he's been doing since coming to America. And he does have a show tonight. The joke is Mightier Than the Sword. It's at the Kimmel Center at 7:30, part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. He also has a book written just a couple of months ago, Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring. And he's got a new podcast coming up called Remade in America. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and we did take some photos of Bassem Youssef that you can check out. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.